Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast. I'm James O'Hara. I'm a nurse practitioner. And today we're joined by a very special guest, Andy Kushner, who is a physical therapist, manages a team of physical therapists here locally. And personally, I'm very appreciative of him because he helped me tremendously in my pec tear rehab over the last, you know, roughly 6 months now. I think I'm 6 months post-repair. So we're very excited to have Andy on. It'll be a good conversation. And could you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and who you are, what you're about?
Sure. And thank you for having me. Thank you for tearing your pec so that we could get to know each other.
Anytime.
We have a shared history there. I tore mine in 2015. So I'm always, you know, a little excited when someone comes in with that injury. So I work orthopedic physical therapy. I've been in that practice since 1999 after graduating from University of Missouri. Been with a company called Athletico my whole career. Athletico is a Chicago-based physical therapy, occupational therapy, as well as athletic training services, and based in Chicago, and kind of grew throughout the Midwest. And then at this point now, like multi-regional, we're not everywhere nationally, but I would call it multi-regional. So, yeah, so 26 years in that setting. So I've gotten to see a wide range of patient types, and you'll never see everything, but doing what we can to stay on top of everything that's developing in your world of medicine and on the surgical side.
Yeah, I think all of us sitting here are lifelong learners. I think, I forget what the example was, but there was some kind of you set something up against a wall on top of one of these like foam rollers, and you're like, 25 years it took me to figure this out. Like,
yeah.
Lifelong learner.
Yeah.
So there's always little things.
It was totally mundane, right? I think we were just trying to hold a pad up against the wall to do, you know, shoulder isometrics so that I wouldn't have to stand there and hold it for you.
Yeah, it's like the simplest things is like, you know, but yeah, I think we're all lifelong learners. And a question that we've asked ourselves on the podcast and asked some other guests is, you know, how do you define an injury? And I kind of put it in two buckets here just for fun. Mm-hmm. But one is any injury sustained during training that prevented them from training, working, or competing in any way whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
Or the other extreme, which is it's only an injury if I go to the doctor for it.
Yeah.
So where do you stand on that spectrum?
I would stand more toward the former. I think if you looked at it as the latter, we'd have large swaths of the country that had never sustained an injury. If that was the case,
just like me,
yeah. You only have tweaks, no injuries.
Just a tweak.
You know, it's interesting. I look at it. You know, anything that affects you, and really, I kind of have a 3-day rule for a lot of things. And so, once it's affecting you for 3 days, 72 hours or more, something's at least a little bit wrong. How do you address that? That said, I think there's day-to-day that what we could call symptoms that are just part of being normal and part of living life and maturing and then aging. I look a lot at, you know, what are kind of the remnants of past injuries that people have had that maybe they didn't deal with at the time or have to deal with at the time, and how do those carry forward and affect you down the road, whether it's causal for a bigger injury or just kind of affecting how you move and feel in general. I look at it as just about any situation that's causing you to alter what you do beyond 3 days is kind of my working rule.
Yeah, I think that's a good balanced approach. And maybe the comment there about what people are carrying forward sets up a good segue for your question about, you hear this all the time about people that, you know, got an injury of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the common scenario that we hear about?
The scenario that we hear about most common is I did blank or I hurt blank,
mm-hmm.
therefore I cannot exercise, or I cannot get my scholarship, or I did not go pro, or I am not able to enter this competition, or I am not able to do a very basic fitness assessment that our company does at least once a year.
Yeah,
we do this, by the way. Attendance is slowly going down, and every employee that at least attempts the different things in the Army fitness test gets a $200 bonus.
Okay.
But, you know, there's certainly a tier list best to worst excuses. For example, their back or their knee or whatever else.
Hangnail.
It's one of my favorite memes. The it's usually a couple in the crowd of a given game with the – in the meme, it's always the male explaining that he had some injury in the past and that's why he's not out on the field at their pro match. which, you know, does happen. It's not everybody. We certainly hear that. I think in our case, for the active population, it's sometimes the case that people don't seek our help. I think there's this fear that they're going to be told, oh, this is wrong, you need to shut it down. And, you know, for 80-90% of the things that we see, we can work with adjustments and some short-term activity modification, and then addressing, if we want to just group it in what we do, addressing the affectable mechanical side of how it is that they're training or participating so that they can work their way back. And there's going to be – it's a small subset of injuries that are really going to cause you to have to shut it down. You know, pec tears in that category, you know. Does it mean that you can't still take care of your overall health and keep moving and be on a reasonable program with lower extremity exercise, core strength, cardio of some kind, even if it's modified compared to what it is that you like to do or that you were doing? There's going to be a period of time where you're disusing the injured site, but it doesn't mean you're relegated to zero.
Let's phrase the question this way. You've gotten an injury, and presumably you were able to, or let's say you did do the correct rehab and or surgery for this injury, and it's been more than a year. You've been rehabbing it, presumably going to your physical therapist or your naturopath or chiropractor, or you could just pray about it. In actuality, you've been going to your physical therapist. You've done good rehab for more than a year.
Okay.
Should any individual of any age or almost any age be able to deadlift 100 pounds, walk or jog a 15-minute mile, row at some pace on a row erg, and pull a lightweight, say, 50 to 80 pound sled with low friction back and forth?
Sure. I would say, yeah.
Is there an injury
that from that standpoint, there's gonna be a very small subset of injuries or conditions that would keep you from a purely orthopedic standpoint, let's say, you know, below those
fractures maybe,
below those
bilateral leg amputation.
Even then, one of the ladies that goes to run club with us has two prosthetic legs.
Yeah. Yeah. And so and
she runs much faster than a 15-minute mile, probably more like a 6 or 7 minute mile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say the injury history, let's say, that is still preventing someone from taking on that level of activity or being able to achieve that level of capability, you're looking at a very small subset of injuries. You're looking at that point at more likely difficulty with mindset, assuming you had it before, reestablishing your mindset. We've been doing a lot of work in the rehab and like strength and conditioning worlds for helping our patients and clients to like, you know, what's really going on with someone's, you know, confidence as they should be getting back to activity, whether that's very high level, like in a competitive sport, or whether that's their own training at whatever level, or whether that's just, you know, doing day-to-day real life things. I mm-hmm. think we're starting to fill in the blanks a little better there and giving people better tools. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say, you know, when you kind of lay out those, you know, criteria for baseline levels of what I would call capabilities, I can't think of a better word than subset. Going to be a very small subset of physical circumstances that would prevent that.
Yeah, and I think this stems from sometimes people like us in the medical community are, not us personally, but physicians or NPs out there, are not giving people the greatest advice. If mm-hmm. somebody's coming in with, you know, chronic low back pain and they hurt it bending over to pick up groceries, mm-hmm. they're going to tell them avoid spinal flexion, or they're probably just going to say, you know, don't do that anymore. You know, because you see, oh, this person does this, gets hurt. It's like, stop doing that. Instead of saying, how can we strengthen that system mm-hmm. or make you more resilient to this injury?
Yes. So resilience is one of my favorite words. you do hear a lot of advice having to do with just a blanket of rest, right? So how long should that rest be? What does working your way back from rest entail? Is full rest indeed the most appropriate thing? What else can you be addressing while you are resting? You know, on the nutritional side, sleep patterns, stresses. There's a couple other categories there. And so I look at... you know, pretty free utilization of pain medication in the same way. You know, there's a small subset that, in my opinion, it's not something we prescribe, and that's not really my world. But, you know, what really requires that type of treatment? And to me, there's a very, very big difference between, you know, this is going to get you through, you know, 3 to 5 days of what might be pretty severe pain, and then you're going to be off of it, as opposed to someone getting 30 or 60 doses in a bottle and really no instructions as to when or how to work their way back to consciousness. So,
yeah, I think that's definitely an important concept. You know, that's one thing the medical community has learned. That's why for physicians and NPs, there's mandatory education regarding pain medication. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we continue to be lifelong learners, as we mentioned. I get almost all of my information from TikTok and Reddit.
Sure.
And Dr. Joel Seedman. And maybe we should check out some of his information or videos as well and see what you think.
Sure.
So he is a credentialed individual. I think he has a PhD in exercise science, but, mm-hmm. you know, what's credentialed and what's practical are sometimes very different. So, Drew, can we play the clip of the Dr. Seedman? I think that's the Instagram one. So what do we think about this training technique?
All right.
I may be mistaken, but I feel like this is probably not the very best way to activate the tibialis anterior. But what are your thoughts?
I think there's other ways that you could do it. I look at concepts and components, right? So you named a good component there. The concept is not going to work for many people. I wasn't that familiar with the Seedman's until just a couple weeks ago when I was looking at some references to be prepared to talk with you guys. Let's put it this way. At this point in my career, I don't really close my mind to much. I think what happens in a lot of cases when things are being posted is you're going to post like some extremes that are eye-catching. And hopefully a lot of your programming for real people is, you know, closer to a core of practical and applicable movement training, you know, in this case, right? So, you know, if for someone who is prepared to push their body to this level, they could throw something like this in there to spice up, you know, hip flexor and anterior tib along with some core activation, and they'll be okay. What percentage of the population does that apply to? Not much of one. And that's always my concern, you know, when you're putting that information out there, let's say, or those examples out there, is like, okay, you know, what group of people is going to be your next 500 people to try it? And where is that going to take those people? That's what's concerning to me when you've got things like this just out there for the world to see. I don't think there's I think, you know, there are some very extreme things that if people have prepared their body to be resilient to it, they can train that way, at least as like a component. I wouldn't want it to be like, mm-hmm. Even for this particular athlete, I wouldn't want it to be, you know, all of his programming, right? So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
My thought with this is, since his kettlebells are on the dorsal aspect of his foot,
mm-hmm.
that is probably the rate limiting step and the most difficult part of this exercise.
Mm-hmm.
He looks strong enough to where he could be overloading his pull up heavier mm-hmm. and likely getting a better response.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I suppose from the rehab aspect, maybe he is trying to train his anterior tibialis, but there's no mention of it in the post.
Right.
And it said he's trying to double his strength and muscle mass. So mm-hmm. this is not the best way to double your strength and muscle mass, is to limit yourself by your anterior tib.
Yeah. I think you were spot on when you mentioned this is like, you know, going to get the most clicks or views or attention because it's something extreme.
Yeah.
To me, I look at this and it's like if you took an AI who didn't know anything about exercise science and you asked it to create a compound movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's like compound movement, multiple muscle groups, and it threw something like this together.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, maybe I didn't have enough chains and kettlebells in my rehab protocol.
I think, you know, during your recovery from pec repair, we definitely could have hit your anterior tib harder.
Yeah.
When are you going to incorporate butterfly pull-ups into your pec rehab?
Yeah. Are you familiar with butterfly pull-ups, mm-hmm. CrossFit and that sort of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Enough, you know, I've seen it. Not something
we can take
participate
another look
in. Yeah, sure.
It helps.
Yep.
Yeah, let's play that middle one, the middle one first.
That one.
There you go. Is that a no chalk gym? Oh, nope. He's got chalk.
There's chalk.
Yep.
Maybe not enough chalk. Maybe he's like, oh, I forgot the chalk on that.
He chalked. Oh, he's going again. Wow.
There right. Yeah. Well, there's the mental resilience.
So can this movement be done safely? And like, what do you think about the shoulder
mm-hmm.
anatomy and the stresses put on that mm-hmm. whole system in this kind of movement?
Yeah. It goes back a little bit to what we were talking about in the first clip. You know, someone who's like prepared, conditioned, has some background in those more, if we want to call it like gymnastic movements. Cool. Would I want it to be the only way that even one of those people is training that movement pattern, if we want to call it that? No. I would look at something like that more as, you know, like a almost like a CrossFit modification for competitive purposes, right? Like, how can I rattle off the most of these in my unit time when I'm in a competitive environment? And you probably train it to a degree so that you can get as good at that as possible for when you are going to be a competitive environment. You know, for most people going into, and it's kind of how I have to consider things. Most people going into a gym like that for their first several sessions aren't really prepared to take that on. And you're much more likely to what's your risk to benefit ratio look like? If risk is injury and benefit is truly getting stronger and healthier, I don't think your ratio is really in your favor with those types of movements early on. If you are well guided and on your way to proper training for it, and then using it as a training tool, that's a different conversation. We had a patient years ago, and this is usually the population I'm thinking of because it's what we do. He had a rotator cuff tear, pretty typical profile for it. Early 50s, attorney, was trying to get more active and fit, and went to a CrossFit style functional training gym. Had the shoulder problem develop pretty quickly. Was working with one of my other therapists. Went for a second opinion to one of the orthopedic surgeons that we worked with quite a lot up in the Chicago area, who was a very practical guy, high level, Division I football player himself. And when he came back from the second opinion, his therapist asked him what the doctor told him about it, and he said, well, he really started off with more of a question. Like, okay, what was it? He's like, what the hell were you doing hitting a tractor tire with whatever it was, 15-pound mallet or something? And he's like, I don't know. I was doing what they told me to do. So, what does your exercise prescription and your dosage look like? Mm-hmm. That's usually where that's how I have to look at it. And that's where my concerns come in with anything that's kind of caught steam here over the last 20 or so years.
Yeah. Well, you answered one of our pending questions, which was, have you ever seen someone get hurt during mm-hmm. CrossFit?
Yeah.
Which the answer is usually yes, but it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
We talk a lot with patients about prehab because we have people mm-hmm. that come to us and maybe there's some life event or a family member or something happens and they're like, I need to do something about my health. So they make some very drastic changes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great that people are motivated like that, but sometimes we have to say, hey, let's take this a little bit slow, mm-hmm. especially on the exercise part of it. And I know you did this personally whenever you started doing CrossFit. You didn't go out and do a bunch of butterfly pull-ups and, mm-hmm. Max rep or max weight snatches and things like that on day number one.
Yeah, I do this for every sport. So regardless if it's basketball or football or mm-hmm. soccer or CrossFit, the first 6 months or so that you start a new sport, you're just getting used to the movement patterns. Mm-hmm. You have to put the ego aside. You can ego lift, you can ego football, you can ego CrossFit.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the point of things like kipping pull-ups, butterfly pull-ups, even functional fitness movements. Like, I don't think people do hammer and mallets anymore. That was kind of a fad that went mm-hmm. out. But even things like a pegboard mm-hmm. and a lot of gymnastics.
Yeah.
Those are for the point of competition.
Yeah, vision quest.
Just like, a football tackle
mm-hmm.
is not the best way to train strength.
Mm-hmm.
But people obviously practice football tackles and they do football tackles in a game.
Yeah, you have to be good at it if you're going to do it.
Yes, because there's new rules about no head-to-head mm-hmm. collisions for a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of sports can learn how football has tried to make that sport safer.
Mm-hmm.
And, functional fitness, at least a lot of some of them are trying to make it safer mm-hmm. by, eliminating butterfly pull-ups from low and mid-level competitions, uh-huh. eliminating headstand push-ups from low and mid-level competitions.
Guardian right. helmets for headstand push-ups.
that would be hilarious.
Yeah. So that's the giant baseball caps.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that'd do the trick.
Jumping into a sport like baseballs. Yeah, if you took 30 and 40 and 50-year-olds and instead of doing functional fitness in their free time, if you had them, play actual football,
mm-hmm.
American football, then they would have even higher injury rates.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I come from a rugby background, you know, grew up with American football, found rugby, didn't play American football. My mom wouldn't sign me up. You know, so as you just mentioned, you know, really starting lately to get serious. Mm-hmm. You know, what are our best tools or combination of tools, because it's not going to be just one, to reduce head injuries to a more acceptable level, mm-hmm. you know. The rugby-style tackling has been a big part of that. Mm-hmm. Training your way upward as opposed to running, you know, drills mm-hmm. with 10-year-olds where they're, you know, planting the crown of their mm-hmm. helmet in another 11 or 12-year-old's face mask.
Yeah.
You know, you see the bad things out there. You're starting to see more mm-hmm. more of the good. And
any advice yeah. for someone whose wife is being recruited for an adult women's rugby league? She's built like a linebacker.
Yeah. She will probably really enjoy it. Learn how to tackle properly if you're going to get serious about playing. Mm-hmm. They'll be spending every rugby club I've had experience with at any age spends a good amount of time at each training session teaching fundamental tackling. They don't assume people know it. One of the risks for American players who are transitioning is that they may have grown up with a helmet on and putting their heads in places where their head doesn't belong when they don't have a helmet or even when they do.
She hasn't done the first part yeah. that I know of.
yeah. But learn how to, you know, if you're going to get serious, obviously there's a conditioning, you know, side to it that's multifactorial. And then you need to learn how to tackle properly. You know, the tackler is at just as much risk in some cases more. Yeah. And so, you know, you do want to take that seriously. We had a neighbor whose son was transitioning to tackle football after kind of just being approached about, you know, coming out for it, and was transitioning from soccer and was planning on just showing up and being the kicker. And they're like, hey, you're pretty fast and you're big enough. Let's have you play defensive back too. And he was excited about it, you know, and when we talked about it, I'm like, oh, that's great. Like, how much time did they spend explaining how to tackle properly to you? He's like, what?
Yeah.
you know, those situations are concerning. So my advice would be if you're interested in playing, there's a whole lot of things that we would like to condition if they're not already to be resilient to the running and sprinting and proper tackling techniques.
Yeah, it's very run heavy, and you know, you got 2 40-minute halves with very little downtime compared mm-hmm. to like American mm-hmm. football.
Your true like participation that. Is much higher.
Yeah,
yep. It's one of the things that makes the studies differ. You know, a football roster is more than twice as big for most of the studies. They count as participants. Mm. They might be participating in 0 to 3 plays. Your punter counts. Every once in a while, a punter gets in there and tries to do something, and more power to them. But in most cases, you know, your kicking specialists are not that exposed. So, whereas, you know, rugby, if we're comparing for Union Rugby, is a roster of 23, and in this era, all 23 are likely to participate in some way in a game where the ball is in play for in a non-pro level rugby match. It's going to be in play for about twice as long as it is in American football, and close to 3 times as long if you're talking about really, really high level play. So,
yeah. And going back to the pec tear, I think you have a much cooler story than me as far as the pec tear. I had your textbook kind of, you know, male bench pressing, mm-hmm. felt it, knew exactly what happened. I was like, you know, educated enough to know, okay, I don't need to go to the ER for this. I just need to get some imaging and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it doesn't bruise tomorrow, and then bruise tomorrow. So mm-hmm. that's my story that the audience has heard me talk through. Now, your story.
Did Kyle accuse you of ego lifting up to that point or no?
No.
No, you're really not an ego lifter. You were lifting light for you that day.
I remember you telling me it was like a busy day and where going on the bro ball bench was like your one alternative to kind of keep your day moving. So it's kind of bad luck.
Yeah. It's just gyms are too busy, which is good. People are active and training, mm-hmm. but I think I've sworn off the flat barbell bench. I did it before, but now I think I'm good. I'm just going to stick with the dumbbell.
I'll do it for you.
And yeah, and my strength is actually back to probably knocking on 80%, kind of like you'd predicted this point 6 months. And there's more strength there, but I'm just kind of progressing up slowly.
Yeah, you work your way to it.
About every 2 weeks, I'll add 5 pounds of that dumbbell that I have in the right hand.
Mm-hmm.
But to go back to your story, you know, how did you, tear your pec and then – you know, the subsequent management of that and your rehab, kind of talk through some of those things.
Sure, yeah. So we talked a little bit about rugby, and I can talk about rugby forever, so you guys might have to stop me. But I found the sport, or it found me in college, played for several years when I was back in Chicago and focusing on work and getting married. I took a year off, and that year turned into 15, and then thought it would be a brilliant idea to jump back into some play and see if I could get fit again and still do it. And my wife supported me in doing so with some trepidation and side eyeing, and that's what I did. And I was back and playing more than I thought I would, honestly, and jumped in during scrimmage at the end of a training session before our first match that fall in what we call team run, and jumped into a position that I'd never played before because someone had subbed out and we couldn't run our next scrum without someone at that particular position. So I'm like, hey, real quick, I'll jump over there. And for anyone familiar with it, I jumped into a second row spot and was holding on as instructed to my second row partner. Ball went into play, front row collapsed. I tried to still hold on, and basically I got my left arm was run through, for lack of a better term, and I immediately knew I did something wrong. It was audible. My arm instantly went like cold and numb, like full on inhibition, and I was hoping it was my biceps tendon because you don't really need it. It became pretty clear with my own analysis while avoiding passing out and with our athletic trainer who was on site for that session that it was my pec, and had surgery a few weeks later and rehabbed it with a little bit of help from my wife, who's also a PT. Range of motion came back pretty easily, which I believe was also your experience.
Yeah.
It's a big bulky tendon, but it's outside the capsule, so range of motion tends to come back relatively easily. And then just followed the rules and for the protective period over the first 5 or 6 weeks, and then started progressively strengthening it. And for me, it was right about 6 months that I was back into some contact at training. I wasn't doing like full live tackling. As we spoke about, our about 80% of the strength in it came back, close to no effort, just progressively strengthening it. It really didn't take, more than a session to progress to the next step until I got above 80%. And then realized once I got back at training, cause I tried to lift for a line out and my left arm wouldn't move as I was, lifting our jumper, that I needed to focus on more of that kind of explosive upper extremity plyometric, if we want to call it that, to regain that. And once I got that neurally going, that came back too. I would rate myself now, I'm 10 years older. Again, I just turned 50. would rate myself at 100%. Similarly, I spent a lot of time not doing barbell benching, just didn't really feel comfortable with it, but I was at full strength with dumbbells. I've reincorporated some bar, not as heavy as I would have trained pre-injury, but enough to still get, a different stimulus, and it's pretty comfortable and reasonably strong, even though it's not really, the focus of my training. So
yeah, and I think I could go back and do barbell bench, because some of the study protocols where they're looking at different types of repairs for this injury, mm-hmm. they actually have them go back like 12 months later and they're like, how much can you bench now?
Yeah.
And I assume that's just big orthopedics trying to keep the money train rolling along. Actually, we're going to have my surgeon on the podcast, I think Monday.
Oh, good.
So I'll bring that up with him and say, what's going on there?
Yeah. But, I think a lot of that comes back to what we were speaking about earlier. You know, what's the confidence level for just getting back into that particular movement when that's how it was injured before, and where we know that in the absence of a traumatic mechanism, right? Like mine was more on the traumatic spectrum in the absence of a traumatic mechanism. It's one of the higher risk activities. You know, most of your TikToks of pec tears are going to be benching with a bar.
Yeah. With Larry Wheels.
Yeah. Specifically with him. Yeah.
Also audible. You know, usually you can hear it. And I don't advise people not to bench press. I wouldn't have them do it in the first, 6 or 8 months after a repair. But as far as, the risk associated for a up to that point healthy person, you know, there's benefits. Again, if we talk about that ratio, you've got benefits that outweigh the risks. You've got good alternative ways to strengthen those systems that can maybe reduce that eccentric loading, but also help you be more resilient to it. That's where I think that balance comes in.
Yeah. So when you're benching now and you're thinking about, that injury risk or how to prevent that, and we had a discussion about this a little bit, thinking about things, isometrically, like, I think I was checking all the boxes because I would do, dumbbell flies with a very slow eccentric, mm-hmm. Maybe even pausing at the bottom, getting a good full range of motion. So I don't think I was like necessarily weak in that range of motion. Mm-hmm. But are there any things that you incorporate other than, working with reasonable weights and not ego lifting,
sure. mm-hmm.
to specifically prevent a recurrence or a pec tear?
Yeah. I look at it, it's going to occur like all soft tissue injuries. It's going to occur under eccentric load or as you're first transitioning from eccentric to concentric in that plyo phase. And so several of the things that you described, and if I was to be more specific, there's actually like some old school training methods that I would use, doing push-up variations where you're like getting some air and where you're having to kind of train in that landing, so to speak, on your hands, more the shoulder and upper extremity plyo phases. Some other variations that change eccentric emphasis without really like a weight-related overload. So being in offset positions, one hand on a medicine ball, one hand on the ground, one hand on a dumbbell, one hand on the ground, each hand on a dumbbell so that you can get, more depth on your push-ups. And these, again, I'll assume that you've trained up to that point, but I think they're good variations for building that resilience and that capability.
Yeah, and I've incorporated the hopping or, mm-hmm. explosive type push-ups now. I'm not clapping behind my back yet, but
not yet.
They feel surprisingly good. There's mm-hmm. no DOMS there. Nothing feels off where the graft is at.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be really happy with where I am at this point. Just feels like it's been pretty linear progress without a lot of setbacks.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, we can't always promise that it'll be as linear as your experience has been. So it's been cool to see it, honestly. I'll get in trouble with the other PTs if I also don't mention some of the other, balancing. How is your core strength, which is a very broad term, how integrated is your shoulder complex with your core per se? How does that relate to what you're doing for scapular training? We don't really want to see, obviously, if it's for competitive purposes, there's going to be some skewing, but we don't want to see people who are just bench pressers. So, we would try to be helping people to condition the big picture in terms of scapular stability, rotator cuff recruitment and control, getting that integrated in with the core, so that you can produce and resist force properly.
Yeah, I that's important to mention because I think probably the most core work that I've done in years was actually rehabbing my pec. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting for people to think about, but you know, it does matter. And you know, I think it was beneficial, even if it wasn't, you know, feeling like at the time, oh, this is helping my pec. It's going to translate to other things like my stability in a squat or mm-hmm. my core, you know, being able to activate that for a deadlift, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And any athletic things where I'm doing dynamic movements, it's mm-hmm. just going to all snowball in a positive direction.
Yeah. And in some cases in that rehab environment, we're trying to, you know, think of ways, okay, what can we do that's going to benefit this patient, and in that case, you, that in that environment, some of the core strengthening gives us an opportunity to start to get your pectoral, in that case, involved and stimulated without it being isolated and really, you know, emphasized to the point that it's at risk. For the patient, it then provides a good opportunity to kind of refocus on those elements that have kind of gone to the wayside, just as people, you know, move forward in life and they're pressed for time and they have other commitments and they can't be, you know, spending 45 minutes doing like a high intensity, let's say, targeted strength session and then going back later in the day and still spending, you know, 30, 40 minutes on, you know, accessory musculature or core training or whatever we want to look at. There's other things you have to do in life. And so gives us a good opportunity to reincorporate those things for your overall health and to address the injury.
Yeah. In thinking of like the linear and speed of recovery, you know, there's all this sort of lore around professional athletes and mm-hmm. what they do to recover. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see them go in the oxygen tent and they've got the trainers working on them. And, mm-hmm. and you know, corticosteroid shots are used. Corticosteroids are used in general.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard things like, you know, these people are like, if they even tweak something, they're going getting PRP or something injected like the same day. Mm-hmm. What are some of the differences in just terms of like the resources sure. or the things that, you know, like, you know, pro athletes, the Chicago area are doing compared to your, I guess, recreational athlete mm-hmm. in the general population who's going to take some ibuprofen for a couple of days and then kind of slowly go back to normal.
Yeah. I think resources is a great thing to look at. I also think lack of other factors in many cases, not in all. So how well can a pro or scholarship athlete, you know, focus their time on what they need to do to get better? And then what are the resources that are there? So, you know, it's a famous case, I'd feel comfortable naming it. You had Adrian Peterson kind of reset a lot of people's expectations for coming back from an ACL injury. He came back. I think his timeline for playing in that NFL opener was like right around 9 months. 9 months, as it's happened, has since kind of turned into more like the magic number for where your outcomes just look way better. You know, even if someone's ready, you know, even by the objectives you can measure at month 6 or 7, the outcomes just prove out to be better if they're held until month 9. They made some other adjustments for it to be as successful as it could be in terms of how they ran their offense. It's important to note that, in my opinion, a guy like that is a step in physical and orthopedic evolution that 99.9999% of the population has not taken. It's just a different guy, you know. So, in addition to that, on the resource side, he has full-time, very focused assistants, and you're talking for a lot of the days that he was rehabbing, it's 2 sessions, sometimes 3. And the important thing to note when people want their young athletes to do more and more and more is that if it was a day with 2 or 3 sessions, everything other than one of them is recovery based. Mm-hmm. And so those resources are different. The ability to focus time, energy, effort. Not everybody does a great job of it, even though it's available, but being on top of the nutritional side, obviously the teams and individuals who are in that environment have really, really good resources for nutrition and for customizing it. You know, proper sleep, that gets harder in season with the travel. You know, probably the biggest factor for me, you know, when we look at how athletes make it through their competitive season, especially when you're talking about basketball and hockey, because you might be in a different place every day for months at a time. And if you're not able to sleep on the plane or fall asleep as soon as you get to your hotel, you're just not sleeping. And so, but anyway, while rehabbing and certainly during the off season, they've got pretty good control over those aspects of their lives if they're interested. Not everybody manages it well, but they have a better ability to do so.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on NSAIDs in general? I mean, I think they're overused by some people mm-hmm. and underused by some people who would benefit from sure. them. Mm-hmm. But especially around like an acute injury. Yeah. I've seen some hints of data that it might slightly impair the speed of healing. Mm-hmm. Certainly like with a fracture, I think there's some data there. But I guess from your background and you know, kind of being and looking at a holistic view of all this, what are your thoughts with the NSAIDs and injury context?
Sure. And again, it's not something that's in our world of prescription, but I do get asked a lot of questions about it. And then for things that are, you know, self-care, you know, over the counter, you know, pretty comfortable offering advice to people about it. I look at it, everything I think about happens in threes. If you're day three or beyond and you're not really starting to feel like you're recovering from whatever acute episode occurred, your system is telling you that it needs some assistance, right? So there's the benefit of inflammation, right? It's a stage in healing. It's the first one. Usually when I see people in clinic, unless it's someone coming in to see us for a free assessment or someone who's just being very proactive, you know, the day after an injury and they come in and see us without consulting another medical professional, which we can help with, usually by the time I'm seeing someone for an evaluation, if they're still having localized pain or they're still having swelling, it means something has gone awry with the inflammatory process cycle, right? So in those cases, assuming they're not contraindicated for it or have stomach problems with it, I think I think it works better when it's reasonably intensive, bout of NSAIDs can be helpful for that person. So when those situations arise, you know, someone who's 10 days from their onset, let's say, or 10 days from their injury, as an example, you know, is it likely to be helpful for that person to do 48 hours of, you know, the dose that the label allows and just do it like for that 48, maybe even 72 hour period? And I tell them, like, kind of picture a wave of this medication hitting your system and then passing through and you're done with it and see how much of a change it'll make for you in terms of your local pain or any swelling associated with it. I'm kind of on the same boat with icing for local injuries. Mm-hmm. There's been some stuff out, you know, the last several years that, where people are looking at it as like, well, we don't want to have ice, you know, interrupt the process or whatever. But again, if the process has proven that it isn't working, it's going to need some help. And, you know, so kind of the same recommendations along those lines. Even a little sooner if it is swollen, you know, swelling's more of a flag for me, you know, at first glance than local pain is. And so, yeah, that's how I look at those situations and usually the advice I would offer.
How about a patellar tendon rupture? Mm-hmm. Let's say a pretty strong athletic individual ruptures it about a week later or so, gets surgery, mm-hmm. wants to rehab it as aggressively as possible. Mm-hmm. you know, they usually ask us questions like what peptides should they take and what else should they do, which is a reasonable question to discuss the risks and benefits.
Mm-hmm.
How can that situation, like how soon can they start? And is there a way, even if they're not technically a professional athlete, if they are, you know, very strong and they've been, been doing athletic things for their whole life,
mm-hmm.
can they accelerate it like a pro athlete might mm-hmm. want to?
I would say for something like that, you know, when you're talking about at the level of like a tendon repair, your recovery is more important than the work you're going to do at that point. And I think there's a level setting conversation to be had there.
Can they start physical therapy?
Mm-hmm.
Like how long should they wait after the surgery to sure. start for a situation mm-hmm. similar to that or yeah. that exact situation?
Yeah.
And then I guess if they are moving through rehab slower, do you still wait for certain times to sure. add things in regardless of how they're doing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So for me, you know, typically someone, if we're talking, I think it's probably a good example. If we're talking about tendon repairs, there's going to be precautions that they're under, you know, that are assigned by their surgeons, right? So those are assigned for reasons, whether that has to do with studies or that surgeon's own experiences in their practice or during fellowship and what have you. And those sorts of restrictions have evolved, right? I believe them to be appropriate as well. In those cases, I'm going to look more at local inflammation control as opposed to systemic, depending on the surgeon, and it might be a conversation that we would have to have directly. You know, are you, you know, with the tissue in the phase that it's in, are you okay with this person, you know, taking an over-the-counter anti-inflammatory? And often the answer is yes, but I'm still compelled to check, and I really wouldn't want to make that recommendation without checking. Those are injuries that I ice. You know, it'll help analgesically. It'll help with the swelling. I ice it with some compression. And then as far as things that they can, you know, proactively do, like let's say if they're not progressing at the pace that they would like, but that pace is within established orthopedic expectation, then that's a conversation to have. If they're falling behind, so to speak, you know, on range of motion, let's say, but we're not supposed to do passive range of motion yet, then I'm going to check in. And it's one of the reasons that it's important that all of us in this, you know, medical field are able to communicate with each other, because that, as you guys have probably discussed, that communication is not as good as the outside world might expect in some cases. So that's why that door being open is important. And I can, you know, if we were still under precautions for James's pec tendon and he was going more slowly than we expected, I can contact his surgeon and like, hey, I know we're not to this point, but I'm concerned about this factor for him. Are you okay with me introducing this technique now as opposed to waiting another 2 weeks, let's say, when it would be within the parameters of his protocol? Mm-hmm. And once we know and trust each other, that answer is typically yes. And so I hope that answers your question well. And those are conversations that we do, you know, have to have on occasion or, you know, bounce it off of a therapist who has more experience with that type of procedure. You know, mm-hmm. does it make sense to do this now? And if so, how do we make sure we're not crossing any lines by doing it? And then we can help that patient move forward that way.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite, in my mind, I think of like these challenging sort of catastrophic injury type mm-hmm. cases when I'm thinking about the memorable ones. But, you know, working with some of the pro teams in the Chicago area, are there some mm-hmm. that are, of course, anonymous, but particularly sure. Memorable or that you were like really happy with the way that rehab outcome happened? Of sure. course, besides my own.
Well, sure. Yeah. Yeah. They ask me about you all the time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, there's one that sticks out. It was one of my pro players, and I happened to turn the TV on to their game like literally 2 seconds before he got hurt. So I saw his mechanism. They replayed it a couple times once he left the game. I think it was before I could pause live TV, but got to see what happened, you know, so and get a pretty good idea for myself of like where was the failure in the system, so to speak. In his case, he had reconstructed ACL. Retears with non-contact mechanisms are actually pretty low likelihood. Your other knee is at more risk than your reconstructed knee. So, assuming the first one was non-contact. So, I had no idea that I would be helping him. And then, like, a couple weeks later, I got a call and was like, hey, you know, can you see this guy in clinic? There can be any number of reasons why a team might not be able to see one of their players. In his case, it had to do with, like, the end of the contract year. So, saw him for rehab. We were able to... focus once he was doing well. Well, kind of back to your point, we were able to start to incorporate some kind of low demand hip and core strengthening that he had just not been doing well with previously. One of the examples of a big, strong, very athletic guy whose stabilizing musculature was just not up to snuff. It's a little chicken or the egg as it relates to his first injury mechanism. Because I just don't know. But I knew it was a problem with his second injury. So we were able to incorporate more of that a little earlier than I otherwise might have. And then as he went through more and more weight-bearing, we were able to transition that to more weight-bearing versions of balance and proprioceptive training with, like, a hip and core emphasis and those sorts of ideas. Without getting too into particulars, I got a phone call that we expected to get from a well-meaning person who wanted to switch him out of supervised rehab and switch him to a different setting. In that case, it would have been very premature, mostly because of the other setting. They got me on the phone with the individual who generates his revenue from the other setting, and I was able to have a conversation with him about the reasons why I needed to keep him with me for that supervised work, but that he could go into the other setting to work on these other elements, upper body strength, some other core strengthening, but that I needed to keep him with me for, you know, the next, what was going to be essentially 8 weeks to make sure we had him really ready to work his way back into on the court activities. He agreed to do so, which dispelled the concerns of the other well-meaning third party, and we were able to keep him in rehab, and he went back and, you know, played into his next contract and beyond, and then he held up well for him. So that one always kind of sticks out, especially because it had some of the elements that I didn't really anticipate, you know, having to navigate or to work with. When you start to work with that population. So it's kind of a cool one and a good pathway to keep in mind.
Yeah. So it just goes to sort of tag on to what you talked about with communication, like, mm-hmm. you know, setting a limit in your case of like, hey, this is the reasoning behind why we need to keep this guy at this stage, at least mm-hmm. for this specific joint, lower body, that yeah. kind of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, a trust in yourself to be able to have that conversation. You know, you don't get there without, you know, the right mentoring and enough of – and those mentors trusting you to be immersed – you know, in those what can be more complex rehabs and complex ancillary situations so that you're prepared to have those types of conversations. And in some cases, you know, do you need to, just as you would with each other, do you need to, you know, put a call in to, you know, one of your mentors or friends or colleagues that you think may have been in similar situations before so that you can prep yourself for it. And, you know, you don't want to pull that kind of conversation out of the sky, I don't think. And so it was really, really important that I had people who trusted me along the way so that I could move forward in building my own practice. So.
Yeah. On the topic of ACLs, you know, I find that really interesting with, like you mentioned, you know, the tearing the contralateral ACL, so the other side is actually higher risk. And some of the twin studies there are kind of remarkable to me. If I'm recalling correctly, there was like twin sisters. I don't know if they were identical or not, but I think the risk is present in either case. But
it's
one gal
higher in identical twins than in why am I blanking
fraternal
on the word?
Twins.
Thank you. Yeah, you let me struggle a little bit, but yes, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the gals, she was, you know, going down the stairs, right, and that was the mechanism. And then it was, I think it was 6 months or a year later, her twin sister, same exact mechanism, going down the stairs, ACL tear. And, you know, it's hard to read too much into that because you can go around blaming everything on genetics, but it's always a combination of genetics and environment. And I don't know if you're familiar with the book, The Sports Gene.
No.
Yeah, it looks at things like your fast twitch muscle fibers and some of the, like, I guess, biomechanics behind things and things like heat dissipation. So, like, if you're a taller runner, for example, over the course of a marathon, you're going to have a harder time getting rid of heat because you have less body surface area compared to someone who's, you know, 5'6".
Okay.
That's why I'm not a good marathoner.
Yep.
There's a reason.
I found it.
Yep, I read it in the book.
Yeah, that's why I never started.
Tall.
But, yeah, I mean, have you seen examples of that where, like, in family members, people run into the same issues musculoskeletally?
Sure. Yeah, I have, and it's hard to know what's what in those situations. And I was looking back through some of the twin study information, and, you know, they're very early on. And so, you know, what I think ACL risk, you know, which is a hot topic and it should be, you know, for non-contact risk, is multifactorial. And you're going to find some factors that weigh a little more heavily than others in at least some people, but there's not going to be, you know, just one. So are we looking at connective tissue quality? Are we looking at little anatomical anomalies with something as simple as where the ligament is? Are we looking at, you know, tensile strength differences? Are we, is there some movement system, you know, muscular dynamic control problem that's going to run more in families, especially in twins? Other anatomic little variances, you know, hip angles and femoral angles and tibial curvatures, and then you get into muscle firing patterns, and you know, they're getting back to some studies for females because it is higher rates in females that look at it as it relates to a menstrual cycle, and so. You know, you're not going to find just one thing that it is for everybody, you know, but there's, definitely something to it on the injury risk side as well as on the performance side. You know, the only real correlation beyond, you know, error explanations for, on the performance side, you know, being a D1 scholarship athlete or higher is having at least one parent who's a D1 scholarship athlete or higher. Like, is that purely from talent? Probably not, actually.
Probably not.
But some of it is.
Yeah.
Injury resilience, right? Having an ability to kind of navigate all those systems and politics as you move up through sports because you've got some experience with it. There's a lot of stuff.
Parents want you to be a D1 athlete, so they tell you to take a lower scholarship so they can tell their friends that their kid is a D1 athlete, and then they make you do club sports starting from age 3 with no fun all the way through.
I mean, it's a dangerous thing to even talk about, you know? And for a majority of the kids, it's really, really tricky, and it can be counterproductive. You know, I've I treated a set pair, a matching set of twin girls who had ACL non-contact injuries. They were mirror images. So one was her right knee, one was her left. I don't remember which one was first. And they were only like, I'm going to say 10 days apart. So like the first sister was like in for her second or third post-op visit with me. They came in and the mom's like, you're not going to believe this, but, and sure enough, her sister had, done her knee. So, you know, they both rehabbed great. As far as I know, you know, they, didn't have anything happen with their own contralateral knees. It was mind blowing for a lot of the patients in the room to see those two going through, rehab, because once you passed about week six, what they were doing was, you know, parallel to each other. They had very similar, pathways to getting better, you know, no big surprises. And so they kind of just got on to what's essentially the same timeline and rolled, you know, but they were in the clinic, like, you know, tossing a ball to each other for balance exercises and then kicking a ball to each other for,
people were like, am I being punked right now? What's going on here?
It was darkly funny, you know, and yeah. I had to remember which one I was talking to at a given time. They were awesome girls. I mean, they were so easy to work with, which obviously, contributes to how well they did. But, yeah, so that stuff's out there. We're working more with, I just, watched a really, really interesting course on, brain mapping after ACL reconstruction, and having to really basically put some more science behind a lot of things that we were already doing with like reactive training when people are in those phases of their rehab and working their way back toward whatever field it is they're going to be on. You know, could you have people who, if you were to map their brain activity as a baseline, you know, prior to having any injury, where it's, let's say, off, you know, up to some certain threshold, maybe we'll find something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Almost like trying to match the brain activity before and you're operating it, you know, with the reaction things at a more of a subconscious level. You're not you're not consciously thinking, okay, I've got to, like me, I'm not thinking, okay, I've got to catch myself at the bottom of this push-up when I'm leaving the ground. It just, it happens.
It's always one of the, you know, it's one of the cliches that's true, you know, in just about any competitive thing that one is going to do. Like, you can't be out there thinking about it. And when someone's been rehabbing and they're, you know, thinking, okay, left knee, stay in position, stay in position, stay in position, stay in position, move my arm, stay in position, move my leg, stay in position, it's very different from how you're going to have to react once you advance phases. So
yeah, same thing for your back after a back injury or perceived injury.
Yeah, and that, I mean, with imaging, there's a lot of, I think, harm that happens from imaging of the back, because maybe it's in that pre-test like counseling session, right? I talk to a patient, I say, hey, you know, you've got this radicular pain that's happening. We're going to take a look. We're probably going to see some things there, but it doesn't mean that's where the pain is coming from. And I always go back to like my early days working in the hospital where we have pain is the fifth or sixth vital sign, whatever it is, thanks to the Sackler family. But we go in and you ask patients, every patient, you know, what's your pain level? And very commonly, younger adults, some back problem, are reporting some level of pain. But then I see these like very obvious cases of like kyphosis in older adults. And Drew or Cameron, maybe we can put a picture of that in post to kind of show people what this is. And it's, you know, you go in and you expect, oh, this person just got to be like suffering. And that's this 80-year-old lady. It's like, what's your pain level? It's like, zero.
Yeah.
So
what,
it's just.
What pain?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I wonder if you see that too in your work where people are like, yeah, I got this x-ray that showed this, or I got this MRI that showed this. And then they become tethered to that diagnosis.
Yeah, certainly. And it's a conversation that we have pretty often, especially because a lot of people in this are seeing us where they expected to get imaged maybe more heavily than they did before they were sent to therapy. And we talk about some of the reasons that that might be, one of which is that, like you just described, you know, for whatever it is we're talking about, whether it's their spine, their knee, their shoulder, you're likely on imaging to show some abnormality, right? Those numbers only go up as you get older, but even someone with, even a younger person with a, more of an acute mechanism, something's likely to show. How does that relate to your symptoms? If it is a source of your symptoms, what's the likelihood that it's going to always be a source for symptoms? And as opposed to, kind of like we were talking about with the anti-inflammatory steps and so on, like what's the likelihood that the situation around that abnormality is just going to calm down, your body's going to adapt to it, and if you can reestablish your dynamic control around, let's say, that joint, that you're likely to move forward with this just proving to be an episode. And those likelihoods for most things are quite high. And so, we have that conversation pretty frequently. And then there are cases where someone who's been working with us and has improved to some point might still go and seek imaging. And they're not necessarily wrong for doing it. I mean, it's more information that you can have to help make your next decision or set of decisions. But I usually, if that person's been making progress, I'm going to counsel them like, hey, like, there's only a couple things you might see that would really generate a distinct change in course for you. So you want to be prepared to just take this as more information in case, another episode occurs sooner than later, or where you get kind of hung up in the, 70-something percents of improvement and might need to take a different step, whether that's, something anti-inflammatory or something with biologics or, a surgical step if that's going to be the move. And but that your MRI doesn't really definitively, in a lot of cases, tell you that. It's just more information to consider for the next decision.
Yeah, and I think we're probably seeing people surprised at the lack of imaging because it's made its way into more CE material now.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, actually, we're doing this, but we shouldn't have been. Kind of like the whole peanut allergy thing. Like, don't give kids peanuts, and then now you realize that, well, you've created a lot more allergies than would have otherwise happened. Mm-hmm. So we find these things out in medicine, and there's changes that get communicated to patients, and how people receive those varies. As far as people who... I'd say a lot of people are always looking for a quick fix, right? So how do either yourself or physical therapists view things like chiropractic adjustments, dry needling, cupping, kinesio tape, anything you want to put in that bucket of like a, a quick fix? And some of the, like maybe some of them have some utility, maybe some of them don't. But I'm curious for people listening, like what is your opinion on the value of each of those?
I think there's certainly going to be cases where especially like something acute or subacute or a new symptom for someone where a chiropractic adjustment done properly can be very useful for them. When then coupled with like proper movement training and reprogramming, depending how that occurred, how their symptoms were brought about. Without painting with too broad a brush, I'm not, we're not typically going to be in line with someone getting, adjustments every week or month on an unending basis. In my mind, if you're going to assume that there's something that is malaligned and assume that it can be physically realigned, if it needs to be done at that frequency, you're actually making it more likely to become malaligned again, which is, probably more my opinion than anything scientific. Some of the other fixes that got out there you know, publicly, let's say, you know, kinesiotape got really popular because of beach volleyball, things of that nature. I haven't seen anything in practice or that leads me to believe that there's a value to it beyond placebo, and at best maybe a little bit of like self, you know, biofeedback. You might feel the tape if you're getting out of position, but you might not because there's a good chance it's already peeling off. So again, that's just my viewpoint. We've been using needling more, dry needling, in clinic. I don't practice it myself. When I've had clinicians who work with me who practice needling, we've seen really good effects. I've had it done to myself, and it's already stuck around and grown at the clinical level in our setting for longer than most of the kind of come and go fads do, if we want to call it that. Taping, cupping, those types of things. I think there's more weight to the needling based on what I've seen it do for people. And that's clinical evidence. I don't know, honestly, what's out there for more like, you know, controlled study. It makes sense to me as a theory. And having experienced it myself and seen the changes it's made for several of our patients who have utilized it, I think it carries a little more weight than some of the things that have come and gone during my time in clinic. But I think we need to look at those things, you know, with an open mind, but critically, you know. That was the thing at the beginning when needling was getting out there, and it's like, well, it's, you know, it's hard to do a controlled study for this. I'm like, no, it's not. Like, you know, yeah. Poke somebody with a pin and do dry needling on something else. The subject isn't going to know the difference. You're making your, that's your, you know, you're accounting for a placebo that way. And, you know, it's, you know, the controls are available. So for me, that was always my concern at the beginning. Like, why isn't there, you know, decent controlled study and evidence? And so I think you do have to be critical about it. But, you know, I don't write anything off until I see what it's doing, hopefully with a population that I know and observe, and then what gets out there, you know, in study.
Yeah. What about a magic wand that makes water more coherent? Is there anything you would say is for sure a gimmick? So this is a Gary Brecka thing that's out there now.
You know, to me, of the things that people are using, you know, I work with a lot of throwing athletes. It's a specialty I developed, again, through great mentorship and some people who really wanted to help me. You know, so I've developed a lot of work and a lot of training and continuing education help for other therapists for overhead athletes and those associated injuries. What's out there now for, like, shoulder bracing for pitching scares me a little bit, but I don't have, like, direct work with it. Like, I've never had anyone in one. I did have one pitcher who came in and said that he had used a kinetic arm kind of brace prior to being sent to see me, but he's not using it now, and he was still sent to see me. So, but that's one. Okay. Yeah. I think to me the kinesiotape is real close to being in that category. I think there may be a little bit of physiology going on there. I don't see much. You know, the KT had to pay, you know, a class action and then kind of redevelop all their marketing and packaging to take some claims out of the public eye for it. But they're still selling it. It's real close to that category as far as things that are out there and kind of widely used. That's another one of my favorite memes. It's happens to be an older woman in a swimsuit approaching the surf for what looks like it would be entering the water for a triathlon, and she's just like, it's from it's a posterior view of her, and she's covered from like heel multiple strips, like up both legs all the way to her hips and stuff around both shoulders, and you know, the caption is like, you know, maybe sit this race out. Like, so, you know, the flip side of it is it's benign, right? Like, unless you're allergic to whatever adhesive they're using.
It's skin benign. Irritation.
And so, like, you know, I don't think it's enough that it's going to have someone really train their way through a serious of any kind injury.
If I would just put some on my pec and attach it to my humerus, it could replace the functionality of the pectoral tendon.
I don't know if it would do that, but if you were, you know, otherwise healthy and, you know, you perform a notch better because you feel more secure about your shoulder, I don't think the KT tape is going to allow you to, pick up a 150-pound dumbbell when you've only got an 80-pound capability. And so, you know, if I don't see a real flag with someone's injury and they think the tape is helping them, like, have at it. You know, it's your $15. You can do what you want with it. So I don't know if it costs $15.
Yeah.
Well, that's good info. I do have one bonus question that was not on our list.
All right.
But I don't know if you've heard this, but I have heard that if you have Achilles tendonitis, then you are less likely to rupture it than if you don't. Perhaps because you rehab it. I'm not sure why. But when I asked ChatGPT, what is my most likely next significant injury, I gave it my body size. I gave it my history, Achilles tendonitis, and relatively poor flexibility, and my family history. And it still said Achilles tendon rupture, which I do have a family history of Achilles tendon rupture.
Okay. Do you have any twins?
I do not have any twins.
Okay.
I have two brothers, and neither one has ruptured their Achilles. Neither has my mother or father, so kind of a more distant family history of Achilles tendon rupture. But would you say that ChatGPT is likely not right, or are you going to predict that, yes, indeed, I will eventually rupture my Achilles?
I would not predict that you indeed will. I am of the line of thinking, based on my experiences with people and what I know to be out there, that if you are playing your way through subacute or chronic Achilles tendonitis, I would put you in a higher risk category until it's treated and resolved. We know the constituency of the tendon changes not for the better. It's likely to actually atrophy. And so you're in higher risk. I don't know where saying that your risk is lowered would come from, other than, like you said, maybe some people treat it. And so ultimately, as they come out of that, if they've treated it well, you know,
I haven't had symptoms in almost a year.
Yeah, their eccentric control is better. There are other factors that affect foot and ankle stability is better. Some of their dynamic programming, brain mapping might be better. It means there's a period of time where maybe the pain prevents you from trying as hard, and so you're less likely to have a bigger injury.
What would you predict is my most likely next significant injury?
Based on a study from a long time ago when I first started, my concern, aside from the Achilles itself, would be one link up the chain, and that would be having a non-contact knee injury of some kind. Whether it's a training related in like an endurance sport kind of way, tendinopathy, tendonitis thing, or if you're working in a high-speed cutting sport, you know, a non-contact ligament or cartilage injury, just because your foot and ankle stability and your ground reactions are going to be impaired. And so that puts you at risk up the chain. That's how I would look at it.
Are there two or three actionable items that I should do maybe on a weekly basis, twice weekly basis, for both the knee and the Achilles and ankle joint?
In a case like that, I look at calf mobility. So I would be rolling, massage gunning, having a friendly partner of some kind who might do hands-on massage, or seeking that care to improve mobility of the calf. One, so it'll respond better when you train it, and two, to take a notch of tension off your Achilles, since your Achilles should be very rigid, right? I mean, it's there to be under tension, but you can still be in trouble relative to that.
I always think my Achilles stiffness helps me be a better sprinter.
It does, yeah. And so, which brings us to the other thing, like you want to get on top of your like eccentric strength of your calf and the rest of that chain, and the transitions from eccentric to concentric, which might at first be very controlled speeds as opposed to what people think of as plyometric, but technically that's the phase, as well as hip stability. So that, you know, we're treating more of the entire chain. And I would, personally, the Achilles is pretty superficial. I'd be icing it and trying to help it locally, you know, with that inflammatory cycle that at this point is either going out of control or spinning its wheels. And some of what is affecting that tendon constituency is the byproduct of that chronic inflammation.
Yeah, I haven't had symptoms in almost a year. Certainly when it was very stiff and less mobile, I would do something like foam rolling or a pre-workout massage, but only before. Mm-hmm. I have heard that the temporary increase in mobility doesn't last very long after a massage or rolling.
Yeah.
So then I would
especially, in an adult.
Yeah, so then I would kind of use that pre-workout only. Mm-hmm.
I look at it as prep. You know, what are you going to do to prepare to move and take advantage of that? Because, and in adults, yes, that increase in mobility, let's say, is temporary. You know,
you're not permanently loosening some fascia, or you're not helping actually remodel the collagen bundles.
Right. If it is, it's at a very low percentage. Mm-hmm. So, how are you ready to do what you're going to do in that day or that session? And you've got probably a few hours, you know, where that's going to be effective for you. I just was looking at the skimming study on different forms of, like, squat training in female rugby players. Here we are again. And these different modes of resisted squat jumps and their carryover to sprint speed. And then how long that lasted, and they were looking at like 40% 1RM and 80% 1RM and comparing their sprint speed right after and then 24 hours after. And that's the, you know, kind of plasticity that, you know, you're talking about, just a different idea, right? Different mode of training, and seeing how that carries over, which isn't your Achilles, but although you better have pretty good Achilles if you're going to train that way.
Certainly.
Yeah, so I can't massage my Achilles to be as the same length as Dr. Gillette's.
No.
I have very long Achilles. That is true.
Yeah, I noticed that on my way in. I just wasn't going to say anything.
Nope. Not great for CrossFit-style squats, I will say. Not great. Yeah. Could be worse, though. Could always be worse.
Yeah. I'm a good squatter, not a very springy runner, though.
Yeah. You should get into Olympic weightlifting.
Yeah, I'll just enjoy my good calf insertions and tell myself that that's all that really matters. That's what women want.
Yeah, you can ask Ocho Cinco about it. I don't know if you've seen
soccer player, lately. Football player?
Chad Ocho Cinco.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. So,
I would like to go back for a second, if I may, and I should say to the chiropractic question. A disclaimer. It's better than a disclaimer. I have several friends who I would trust to the end of this world as chiropractors.
We do
and
too.
I've taken some coursework that was led by really, really good chiropractors who are treating, you know, in quotes, the whole person, and really doing a great job of blending, you know, the movement training and the attention to the whole system with some adjustments and what I think most of the public pictures is traditional chiropractic, and they're blending that in really, really effective ways, and they're doing really, really good work with rehabs and what we call like post-rehab. You know, so you've come to us for your pec repair, let's say for 4 months, and you've been cleared to progress to full activity, and you might go work in one of their settings to work your way back fully to your previous level or a little better of function in the gym or in a sport or what have you, and that does exist, and it's actually a growing proportion of what's out there for chiropractic. So in fairness, did want to make sure I mentioned that.
For sure.
You mentioned free assessments. Mm-hmm. How else could people get in contact with you or work with you if they have an injury or just want to come in and see where they can improve?
We do. Thank you. We do offer as a company free assessments. It's a one-time consult to evaluate an injury. And I always describe it more as like your triage. Is this going to benefit from physical therapy? And here's the reasons why and what we would do. Would you like to do that and come in and see us as a patient for whatever the appropriate treatment plan might be? Which might be very short. Does this have a red flag where we need to, you know, for this reason, we need to have you see a doctor and get a physician's evaluation and consider imaging? That's a different conversation. But it is not really safe for you to proceed without ruling out, you know, what these flags indicate. Or it's kind of more what we were talking about earlier. You know, your shoulder's been painful for several weeks. It's weak, relatively. It's presenting as rotator cuff tendonitis. Is it possible you have a partial tear of your rotator cuff? Yes. We can proceed with treating it, and here's all the reasons that it's safe to do that. You could see a physician first and see if you need to rule out more of a tendon, you know, substance structural injury. And that's really, you know, your call. And I can help you do that in this way. And almost all the time it comes down to one of those three conversations and then kind of help people with what to do next. Patients can come and see us through what the therapy world calls direct access. So, you know, if you pulled your hamstring and we can help you get better faster and more comprehensively, which we can. You can come in and see us without a prescription. And even in those types of evaluations, your insurance will cover it. And even in those types of evaluations, if we spot something that's a different flag that really should get you into a doctor's office, we'll obviously inform you of it so that you can handle that properly and safely and move forward that way. The best way to reach me or any of our clinics, in my opinion, we have a few methods. Athletico.com has a pretty easy ability to search by your zip code and find the closest one. You can also just search by state. It's broken down state by state. I think Kansas City actually has its own search since we're on a state line. And then we can help you to set up from there. You can make an online appointment request, excuse me, that way, and that gets sent immediately to the clinic you choose, and we'll be able to call you same day to set you up. We really, it's a real thing. Unless you, the patient, have restrictions to your own schedule, we'll get everybody in and, you know, within two working days. I think those are the easiest way to get directly in contact with us. My clinic particularly is here. Well, we're in Leawood with you guys now. I'm in Overland Park at 95th and Antioch, and we do have 19 locations around Kansas City if you consider Lawrence the Kansas City area, which I would. That gives us 19 in the Kansas City area in the metro.
Yeah. Excellent.
Well, thank you. I only have good things to say about my experience and, you know, responsiveness, appointment flexibility. It worked out really well.
Yeah.
So, you know, thank you so much for your time.
Sure.
And thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I was excited when you asked, and obviously a really good indicator of the experience that you had with me and with everyone else in our clinic. So I appreciate you inviting me to be on with you guys.
For those that are watching, whether it's a question for James or myself, really whoever, physical therapists in general, chiropractors, leave a comment below. And otherwise, thank you for your time, and may God bless you with health and happiness.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.